Session number 9271, real one.
Brigadier Vickers, real one. You joined the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry in 1934. Were you a regular?
Yes, I went to Sandhurst, did my 2 years there, and then joined the 1st Battalion at Tidworth.
Why did you choose that particular regiment?
I think because I was at Clifton in the Corps, and very keen, and my last camp at Tidworth Pennings, the 1st Battalion Care while I looked after the camp, and I was very impressed with the sort of air of happy efficiency. And there was a particular chap called Leslie Wheeler, a captain who was running the camp, who was a delightful man, and I think possibly put his eye on me, because I was something of an athlete and played cricket for the public schools and things like that, and I think he invited me, and he took me to lunch in the mess. I was a cadet under officer, and I was deeply impressed, and so on and so forth, but they were a very happy bunch at Tidworth.
Was there a tradition of military service in your family?
No, we've all been doctors or sailors, and I'm the renegade soldier for about 5 or 6 generations.
How did your family feel about you becoming a soldier?
I've never thought of that. I think my father was slightly disappointed that I hadn't become a doctor. But otherwise, they just accepted it, and I was just a soldier. I don't think they'd had any effect.
I think you served in India and Burma in the 30s.
Yes, I went to India in January 35 and did 2 years in India and then 3 or 4 years in Burma. And I saw it under those wonderful days of the Raj. And what a wonderful life it was.
Must have been something of a contrast to go to France in 1939. And
well, it was an extraordinary sequence of events. I came home to get married in 39, and I was married on the 1st July and went on my honeymoon to France, which was quite exciting in those days. And I remember being for a little in Haiti in there. We were just bundled out. And so we wandered back, and we in fact spent 72 hours in Dieppe, and I took a lot of photographs, and I think they were made use of during the war for the Dieppe raid. That was a fluke. And then I came home. We came back to England, and things were obviously going from bad to worse, and war was absolutely inevitable. And I was due to sail back to Burma about the 8th or 9th of September, but I was recalled to the 1st Battalion at 2:30 in the morning. I was rung up by somebody from the War Office and told to report to the 1st Battalion at Strensel immediately, which I did with clean buttons. I had no kit except one suit of SD, and I drove furiously through the night for king and country, and of course arrived at the battalion, met my great pal, the adjutant, Michael Roberts, who said, "What the hell are you doing here? You're in the 2nd Battalion." Anyway, I arrived and joined them. 1st Battalion came while I... the day before we mobilised.
What sort of condition was your rifle company in?
That's
in the spring of 1940?
I'd go back, if I can, to mobilisation. I took the colours to the depot, took the 1st Battalion colours to the depot and laid them up, or handed them over to the OC depot. And then the depot RSM fell in the reservists, who had by then, by and large, had arrived. And my memory is that there must have been something like 2,000 plus. And I walked down the ranks. And it was known then that I was going to collect a draft for the 1st Battalion. We wanted 275. And I was able to nominate, I suppose something like 150 soldiers that I'd known in the 2nd Battalion for a long time. And various other people said, "I'd like to come, sir." And I said, I wouldn't very well take you if you were the last man in the world, and so on and so forth. And 3 days later, I went back and collected this draft. and they joined the battalion. There was nothing very peculiar about them. They were tough, physically tough, and obstinate Yorkshire miners, mostly. And they blended in very well, coming back to the colours. There was no resentment of being recalled. Everybody rather in a major war, and they rather got on with it. And the actual process of mobilisation was fairly well ordered at Strensel, re-equipped and so on and so forth. And I saw my first Bren gun and tried it, and a monstrous thing called a boys' anti-tank rifle. Then we moved up to Strensel, and various rumours went on that we were going to be detailed to train the second line TA and so on and so forth. But not so, and on the end of September, we went to France through Cherbourg, very efficient move, and by gradual processes arrived up in the forward area at a place called Rousse-Warrandin, and it was cold. And then we went into Bondieu. It was a terrible time for a regular soldier. I had 120 men in my company. I had three officers and myself. I had an absolutely first-class CSM. But we didn't do anything. We didn't train. In the whole of my time in France, from October to April when we left, my company had 1 2-hour allocation of 100-yard range in the moat of a fort somewhere to the south of Lille. And the men were allowed to fire five rounds each. We had no ammunition to use for our boys' anti-tank rifle, and the Bren guns were not fired. We were only allowed to fire the rifle. I never saw my field regiment. I didn't know the name of an FOO or battery commander. I didn't even know the name of the corporal MFCs from the mortar platoon. And all we did was to construct corduroy tracks round Douai Airfield for Lysanders, move pit props, carry out massive fatigue duties of moving stores, and then eventually digging these fortifications, which we dug and we roofed in, and looking back on them, they were absolutely useless death traps. One tank standing off the 75 would have knocked it to pieces from 500 yards and you wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. They were absolutely useless. But we put a great deal of work and effort into them. So my company, on the 16th of April, when the Norway story starts for me, it was strong, it had a pretty good morale, it had got on very well, we had good company cooks, a good CQMS, and the chaps were fairly warm. They were physically hard. It'd been a cold winter. They hadn't done enough marching. A lot of them were old sweats. They could handle their weapons quite well. But they were... their morale wasn't very high, and it's a bit... the reason for this, I've been thinking about a great deal. We did have the fortune to go down to the Maginot Line in January, February, and we were shot over, and we killed our first, unfortunately not a German, he was a Senegalese sergeant who shouldn't have been there, and we shot him, and then they shot at us. So our first firefight was with the Senegalese outside a village called Halstroff, in which they wounded two of mine, and we killed one and wounded four of them. But at least the chaps had been shot at, and at least they'd got some feel of the tension of being in contact. Well, the atmosphere of the BEF was extraordinary because there were always flaps. I think on two occasions we were moving down to the Sommer to do some training with tanks when we were turned round and sent back because there was one of these periodic flaps. And the other thing was that we began to look and see the French army, and we were absolutely horrified at what we saw around us in northern France. But when we went down to the Maginot to see their great Maginot army and their ligne de contact and ligne de recon and their field troops, field army and that, even the soldiers simply couldn't believe that the French would be so slovenly and so badly equipped. It was evident to us that the French army was never going to fight anybody. And I think for that reason, with the flaps and the phony war and the rather sort of funny press coverage, and I don't think morale was very good. We didn't know what we were there to do. We realised we'd dug a lot of deep holes, which we didn't think were much good. And there wasn't much purpose in life.
Was there anything you could do to try and keep morale up during this difficult winter?
Well, I think we made the soldiers work and we fed them well. We did very little. I mean, there's a limit to what you can do in northern France, because if you put your foot in the field, the farmer screams and you can't do it. I managed to get about an area of 1,000 by 1,000. We used to do night exercises, patrols and penetration exercises and things like that. No, I think our training was totally unrealistic for war. And I think the soldiers were probably a bit idle. And I don't think they were certainly not ready for war.
When you shot the Senegalese, was that on a patrol?
No, this was the left-hand post of the British sector in the Maginot. And I took over from the Green Howards, that company. I was a left forward company sitting in front of a village called Halstroff. And at the same time, the French, from a French colonial battalion, changed into a Senegalese battalion. And I had great difficulty in making contact with their company commander. And the second night, this sergeant came up from behind in the wrong way and so on and so forth. And the sentry challenged him and he didn't stop. And the sentry shot him stone dead, whereupon a firefight. You can understand how it would happen. We were unexpected. They were new. We were new. Itchy fingers. I think it was fortunate it didn't. That no more damage was done.
How was the mistaken shooting brought to an end on that occasion?
I think by the stentorian voice of a chap called Topcliffe. Topless. Who was my platoon commander. He spoke a certain amount of French, and he knew where the French should have been, where they weren't, and so on and so forth. And I think by shouting at the top of his voice, he managed to get the message over the other side that it was the British, and it stopped. It went on for half an hour. I was back in the company headquarters. It was about 11 o'clock at night, and I really thought, you know, something had started, and we all stood too, but it was just there. No German reaction at all.
Did you see anything of the Germans while you were on that Maginot front?
I never saw one. I went out, I took a patrol out into a forward village and saw evidence of Germans. There was German ammunition there and things like that. I never saw a German.
Did you do a lot of patrolling while you were there?
No, you were very limited. The French wouldn't let you do more than a very limited program. They didn't want to excite the opposition. You were not allowed to shoot at them with machine guns or mortars. That was forbidden, because they might retaliate and put shells onto French soil. This was all part of this extraordinary atmosphere in that French army sector. They weren't going to fight. It was absolutely obvious to me and to certainly the battalion that the French had They had no inclination to fight.
You mentioned you didn't do enough marching while you were in France. What would you consider to have been an adequate programme of marching?
Well, looking back from experience of the whole war, I think that the battalion should be quite capable of marching 25 miles straight off. And it should, if it's in an active theatre of operations, it should keep to that pitch. I mean, it can't when it's in contact, but when it's training, it was trained damned hard. And, of course, later in the war, we were beautifully trained and fit and everything. But, no, nobody had the idea of training for war in France. I mean, to have 2 hours on a 100-yard range in a theatre of operations was unbelievable.
You say 25 miles straight off. If you were marching day after day, how many miles a day would you then expect a battalion to do?
Well, the 2nd Battalion in India and Burma were great marchers, and we used to work up, and we used to reckon that we could do 20 miles a day with the greatest of ease. And if you wanted to show off, we'd do 30 miles in the day. But we did a great deal of marching there, and the soldiers got fit, and they had a pride in their achievements. And, for instance, we used to march back 96 miles from our annual camp, where we spent 4 hard months. We used to march back in 48 hours, and straight through.
Would this be marching all on roads, or on roads and across country?
Roads and across country, and marching tactically by sections or by platoons. I had a fairly progressive CO in the 2nd Battalion, who believed we ought to be able to move across country.
And in what sort of order would they be for that marching?
Single file, by platoons spread out. The battalion sort of mass would be quite big. We might move on 2 or 3 tracks and go down. And Tom Butt, the CO, used to say to the company commanders, right, I want you there at 6 o'clock this evening, and you ought to follow this route. And that company would say, I want you there at 6 o'clock. Off you went.
By order, I meant rather clothing and kit. Would they be in... would they carry large packs? Would they be on wagons?
No, we had mules only. We carried our Lewis guns. That's what we had in the 2nd Battalion. We carried our Lewis guns on mules, and the man carried a large pack on his back, which was not very large. I think it was only about... It was something like 30 pounds, but he carried 2 days' rations, change of clothing, so on and so forth, and field service marching order with a pack, with a poncho, his hat, 100 rounds of ammunition, rifle. But he'd been doing it for 4 months, so it was nothing for him.
Now, as to the strength of your own rifle company, you said 120, did you have the establishment number of officers and NCOs?
I say yes, because I can't remember the proper establishment. I had a second in command, I had 2 officer platoon commanders and a platoon sergeant major. My figure of 120 could be wrong. It might have been 110, but it was in the order of 120. Yes, I was up to strength in NCOs. We made some new ones, we lost some old ones, and so on and so forth. But by and large, on the 16th of April, when the Norwegian thing started for us, we were a full-strength rifle company, equipped and organised to the set-piece pattern of the BEF then.
I presume that since you had a large number of reservists recalled, the average age of the company would be mid-20s?
Yes, I would think probably a bit more. Some of the reservists were quite long in the tooth. I can remember a man called Brian who was in his mid-30s, and he'd done 12 years in the 2nd Battalion, and he was an absolute ace medium machine gunner, a man without ambition, but a good soldier. He was about mid-30s. Yes, I would say it was in the middle 20s, the average age. They were not the very young people. They were middle 20s.
How did the platoon sergeant major get on? Did you find that it was an efficient...
Well, I'll tell you the story of the platoon sergeant major. And a lot of the things, or some of the things I'm going to say today, are perhaps not very complimentary to the British Army, and not to me. And yes, I had a platoon sergeant major there who was red hair, and he was a good, busty chap, and he was always keen and smart, and his platoon adored him, and he led them very well, and he was always with them, and he was, from my point of view, he was an extremely good platoon commander, rather better under those conditions than the 2 officer platoon commanders I had. He was absolutely first class, and I'd known him in India, and I'd seen him come up through the ranks, and I had a very high respect for him. And he really was very good at training and things like that, and his platoon were there. And When we got to Dunfermline en route to Norway, I was told I couldn't take my platoon sergeant major. And one of my platoon commanders was taken away, and I was given two brand new young officers whom I'd never seen before, who'd just been to an officer cadet school. And I really formed up and laid it on the line, said, you take away one of my experienced officer platoon commanders, you take away my platoon sergeant major, you give me these two children. I don't know anything about them. They're terrified. They've looked at their platoons, and the platoons have looked at them, and there's no mix, nothing at all. If you're going to take away one of my officers, topless, I'm going to take the platoon sergeant major with me. And they said, well, it's a war office order. I took him. And we went to Norway, and after a few days, we were shelled. And I learnt a hideous lesson. That great big red-faced man, who was a superb peacetime platoon sergeant major, was physically incapable of going to war. He was absolutely physically incapable of being shelled. He just disintegrated physically in front of me, and he was useless. And that taught me a great lesson, which I never forgot for the rest of the war. It's not the people who say, oh, let me get up and get at them. It's the funny little po-faced corporal who's got a bow in the back of his neck who saves the day. And it's a lesson I learned. And to judge people. But that platoon sergeant major taught me a lesson.
How did the two young children behave under shell fire?
Oh, dear. Terribly. They both ran away. I don't blame them. They didn't know me. They didn't know their men. They weren't in a very happy situation in their first action. At the critical moment, in the sort of last day in the rear guard, the left-hand platoon, which was the key factor, stood up and ran, led by its child platoon commander. I was rather good shot with the pistol. I missed him four times. And my company sergeant major, we managed to hold the last section that was running, but I lost two-thirds of the platoon and the young officer. And the other young officer stayed with me because I sat in his back and told him, if you go, boy, you'll go dead. But they were no good, and I don't blame them. I've no idea what happened to them after that. They were totally unprepared for war, although I think quite easily they might have been the right stuff and they might have fought very well, but in fact they didn't.
When did you first hear that you were going to be removed from France and sent up to Scandinavia?
At 7 o'clock in the morning on the 16th of April. There was quite an air of excitement about. There had been rumours. The Germans by that time had been, I think, a week in Scandinavia and Denmark and Norway. And I was sent for at 7 o'clock in the morning, which was unusual. Went down there, and the adjutant, John Deeds, a great friend of mine, said, oh, I'm frightfully sorry, we got the time wrong. We went 9 o'clock. And I said, come clean, John, what's it about? He said, well, come back at 9 o'clock. And there was the usual sort of nonsense. And then at 11 o'clock, the CO came back and told the company commanders that we were going to move the next night to Norway. He didn't know more than that, except that the battalion would be prepared to move at whatever it was, 5 o'clock the next night, and that we would shed all our transport, and that we would only take what we could carry, and we were to go back to our companies and work it out. And we were to be prepared to fight in Norway from the moment we got there, carrying all our stuff with us.
How was that news received in your company?
I think with a certain amount of interest and a certain amount of, well, thank God there's something to do now, and so on and so forth. But there was a good deal of consternation about fighting only with what you carried. We were a so-called mechanized battalion. I had a truck, we had a three-tonner, and we had three 1,500-weight platoon trucks. And it was really quite an exercise to know what to take. And we had to sit down with the NCOs and work out what we wanted. And it was very little you could carry. And when it comes to things like the cooks and so on and so forth, one had to say at battalion headquarters, well, I can't carry my cookers and things like that, manpack, that's impossible. What do I do with them? Oh, you'll be cooked for centrally. Don't worry about the cooks, they can stay behind. So we stripped down to man loads and everybody, and it, do you take a blanket or do you... No, blankets would be... You can see there would be a lot of questions to which answers had to be given. But anyway, by that evening, the first evening, I had a parade of the company and the second in command... No, the adjutant came up and we went through it and he'd been round the other companies and there were other various suggestions of bits of kit which would be useful. So I think by the first evening, all the rifle companies... were ready to go, carrying what they could take and nothing else. And it was a mighty little you could take, none of the comforts or anything like that. And great coats, leather jerkins we had, needed those. Field service marching order, a small pack, much as ammunition as you could carry. No rations we didn't carry. Water bottle full, emergency ration, all the first aid field dressings and things like that. And we went through, as a regular battalion, what a soldier had to take, and by and large, we did it well. We knew how to do it, and we were ready to go.
So it was one day to prepare?
Yes, but I was called away various times, and I remember I was called down in the evening, and I had been given the outline plan then of the move, that we were going to the fourth area, and that the Navy would take us from the fourth area to central Norway, and that the target was the airfield at Trondheim. And that made me think. I'd passed my promotion exam, and I was in the middle of a correspondence course for my staff college exam, and I had visions of an assault landing, and I thought, Gallipoli? Was so unsafe. Well, anyway.
Gallipoli with ice.
Yeah. I went down there, and there was Lord Gort. This marvellous man who really was a marvellous commander-in-chief. He knew me by name. He knew me as Bill because I was stolen by the home establishment from the Indian establishment, and, of course, the Indian establishment wouldn't pay me. And until I was posted to the home establishment, nobody would pay me at home. And Chamberlain came out. This is one of my pet after-dinner stories. Chamberlain came out to look at the soldiers and he came to me, my company, with Gort and things like that, where we were digging one of these great holes. Well, we dug a hole and filled it in, so when the Prime Minister came, we could dig out the old hole very fast. And the old man was there. And he had a very nice pair of boots on with gaiters, suitable for shooting partridges. And he came with a huge crowd of hangers-on and talked to some of the soldiers and so on and so forth, and he was very charming. And old Lord Gort suddenly said, William! Sir? Hello, boy. So I went up, and there was Gort next to the and he said, Prime Minister, here's a regular officer fighting for his king in an active theatre of operations, and nobody's paying him. Good heavens, said Chamberlain. Why so? Tell him, boy, so I said.